Yeah, I mean, whoever's in power, whatever the power structure, people do not like dissent. And if they recognize the sort of, I guess, sort of abstract moral need for there to be a place for dissent, or else you might be considered some sort of authoritarian. So you might have a complaints, you know, procedure or a form that you fill in. So you sort of acknowledge people need to have a right to dissent, but they have to do it in the right way. And what that means is in a way that we can ignore it, in a way that we can say, okay, maybe you don't understand the full story, and we can maintain our control. You know, they do this in government, yeah, but they do this in any institution, in businesses. You know, how many people working for a boss are going to tell the boss that they're wrong if the boss can fire them and say they're not a team player, or they don't, you know, they don't.
I mean, they do it at school. We've worked on the student council, and how many times have we been told we can't change the canteen because, oh, you know, it's not our fault, it's someone else's fault, like we can't do anything about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I've been the coordinator of the student council at the school I work at for many years now. And as a rule, if students do something that doesn't go through the proper channels, quote unquote, they get told off for not going through the proper channels. And then when they do go through the proper channels, new channels are established so that they can say, well, next time, let's do this. Here's a committee to do that. And it's all a way of filtering down. I mean, even yourself, you were involved in some Black Lives Matter protests that started a committee at the school that had quite the radical name of the Black Lives Matters Committee. It is now an Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Committee, which is far less clear about what the problem was. And what has it achieved? It's had a few meetings, a lot of meetings, yeah. And now you've left the school. It's got replacements for you, but where are we going with it? I don't know. And all of that is doing things through the proper channels. The reason it existed was because you did not go through the proper channels, and you wrote a letter to the students that you weren't supposed to write, sort of saying, why is the school not doing what it's doing? And my experience is any change that has ever happened in any institution does not happen by going through the proper channels. It happens by disrupting the proper channels. And that includes schools, that includes government, but the changes that we see, and there's usually tutting about how, you know, we've done this thing finally that all the protesters asked us to do. It's a shame they didn't go through the proper channels to do it. We might have done it even sooner if they had, but we've done it now. But really what they're saying is we were forced to do it because of all the protests. So protests should definitely, you know, not be police, should not be going through the proper channels. And I would say if you're going through the proper channels, you're probably going to find not a lot changing.
Yeah. And so that sort of brings us again back to this sort of form of social contract theory, this form of democracy, bringing up about this sort of relationship between authority and individuals. And you draw up on Locke and how Locke sort of says that we're all rational human beings. We all make choices. We all have the ability to make such choices and go from, you know, X to Y if we want to, for example, when we are given that, or like that ability to be autonomous individuals. Why is the faculty for reason so significant? Why is that understanding that human beings make decisions, human beings can be free to make decisions, so sort of important to your ethical legitimization of authentic democracy?
Well, for me, I mean, it does come from a bit of sort of my work in meta-ethical thinking, where I did actually look at the question of how you get an ought from an is. And my feeling is that we get oughts from is's all the time, and we do it through reasoning. It's only when it's a moral one that we're told we can't do it. Usually kind of for the same reason we just said, that the powers that be want to be able to say, I'm not sure that's the right approach to be taking. So for example, you know, if I want to do this interview with you right now, then, you know, there are some certain facts that there is a program called Zoom. There is a way of recording a conversation on Zoom. So we've given those facts. If we want to record this conversation, you ought to get the Zoom call going and get the recording going, right? Not controversial at all. The thing is, the if is the thing. The ought only makes sense if we agree on the if you want to do this. So with ethics, the conversation is about if you want to achieve a certain goal, you ought to do that. And the debate is, well, do we agree on the if you want to do that bit? And so again, back to political teleology, I would say with politics, we've covered the if. The if is whatever that social contract is, that we want to make life better for people. So if you want to make life better for people and you figure out what better and people and all that means, you ought to do that is a completely coherent ethical concept. But reasoning is how we get to our oughts from our is-is and our ifs. You know, if I want to do that, how do I do it? I reason, I think, I've got choices. And basically, you know, I don't believe that there is an ethical truth that comes from God or whatever, but I do believe that there is like options and reason and logic. And the more we think about things, the more we have to give reasons for why A rather than B rather than C. And once we start comparing reasons, we start analyzing that and getting to conclusions that we can justify. So to justify any conclusion and to make any action out of a series of choices, we have evolved the capacity for reason. And so reason, without reason, we don't really have a basis to make meaningful decisions about anything.
And then your sort of argument from there is that it should sort of be taken into account that we have this ability to make autonomous decisions and make sort of options. But, you know, that was drawing off of John Locke, who, well, if you look at sort of him as an individual, wasn't very liberal, but, you know, he's told us sort of this head of liberalism and all this stuff, even though he had slaves or whatever. But if
that's actually an interesting point, because it's about reason, isn't it? And so if you have a worldview that says only some people have reason because only some people are proper people, or some people are less human than other people, because, you know, Locke is, for all of Locke's racism, there is no difference, as Peter Singer would tell you, with some of what Locke would think about certain ethnicities of people and what most humans think about certain non-human animals, right? We don't care about their ethics. We don't care about their capacities for reason. We assume they don't have a capacity for reason, and we don't care if they suffer and feel pain. We're going to kill them and we're going to eat them. Or we're just going to kill them for, like, so I can wear some shoes made out of their skin, which, again, if that was a person, that's insane. Yeah. But we do it with animals all the time. So,
but I mean, doesn't Plato sort of brings this up in sort of the Republic, right? Where he says, and just to push back, to play devil's advocate here, why the need for this authenticity and sort of political power can only come from free, rational, autonomous beings? Why do we sort of need to deal with this sort of democracy nonsense and shenanigans? Why not create a guardian class, like Plato suggests? Why not have philosophers solve all the problems and create philosopher kings? I mean, like, why is Plato not sort of providing us with that alternative, that there's a hierarchy here, right? Like, when it comes to human beings and animals, I mean, human beings clearly wider, better, clearly more intelligent, clearly better at doing certain things. So of course,
the hierarchy is intelligence, because I look at my cat, who doesn't have to work a day in his life and can just sleep and get the food brought to him without even having to do anything for it, and I think, am I more intelligent than that cat? That's a figured it out. But I to your point, Plato has two problems, I would say. He, you know, doesn't believe everyone has the capacity for reason. He thought only special kinds of people did. And his argument from his terms makes a lot of sense. The people who have the best sense of reasoning and the best sense of truth of what the world is like should be the ones in charge, because they're the only ones who can do it. If you disagree with Plato, like I do, and say, well, that's not true, actually, we've all got just as much and just as little ability to know what is true in the world and know what we want. And the thing we're talking about in politics is what we all want, which is all very different. There isn't really an argument to say, well, let's only make this small percentage of people be in charge and the rest of us will do what they say, because their authority is very questionable, because they are as good at understanding the world as I am. And they actually don't know what I know, because they have a different experience than me and by everyone else. So the idea that Plato has all this metaphysics behind it, where there's a world of forms and there's only knowledge gained by certain people that is essential for ruling and all that stuff. If you look at the world from a point of view of equality of people and don't say, well, there's only these special hierarchical people versus these non-hierarchical people, or less lower down on the hierarchy people, that argument kind of falls apart, and we could all be philosopher kings just as easily. The other problem I've always had with that is sort of his idea of a philosopher ruler. They've seen the form of the good. They know the truth. They can rule society because what they say is right. We can never check that, because if I go, well, hang on, what's the basis of that? They can say, don't worry, I'm wise, you're not, you don't understand, just do it. And that, for anyone interested in rationalism and being able to justify beliefs and justify what you do, is kind of unacceptable. I just have to do it because you said so. That kind of authority is always deeply questionable. And so the idea that, like, no one can check what this you know, epistocracy of higher up thinking people believe is correct, actually is correct. There's no independent verification of it. And it's also very dubious that it would ever be correct, for the reasons I said before, that there's no way they would actually know legitimately any more than we would what we want, I just think that that theory falls apart.
And I mean, even onto those points, even when you look at Plato, you might disagree with the sort of his answers to it. But all of these sort of theorists we've sort of come together, you're essentially, your claim and your reasoning, the overarching sort of argument for your, for the first part of your book at least, is that there is this universality of this necessary contract. And ultimately, your analysis of all of these different thinkers leads to what you say is all justifications for the existence of external structures of political power over autonomous human life that have hitherto been seen have been based on some interpretation of the same underlying idea, that political power X is justified because its existence makes life better for people than it would be without it. So I sort of want to get into this sort of questions of better for the people, who essentially are the people and what is better. Because if when you talk about the people, the first part, you open up, okay, who are the people we're talking about? You say that it can be reasonably assumed that the people for whom a legitimate structure of political power must make life better, is, if its existence is to be justified, must mean all people who will be affected by its actions. You yourself admit that this might be a bit too broad in certain situations or circumstances, and I sort of agree with you and accept on that, but what would the process of exclusion actually look like? So how do we exclude certain people from saying, okay, we don't need your direct consent in this situation? Like, what would the examples of that be?
Oh, I don't mean like that. I think you would always need people's consent, but in terms of direct consent, it's like, part of consent can be to give consent for things I don't care about. So currently, as I'm talking to you, my wife is doing some gardening. It's our garden. It's both of our gardens. We'll both enjoy it. But I'm not so fussed about what particular flowers are in that garden, right? So even though it's my garden, as much as it's her garden, I have consented that she can make all the choices about what flowers she's planting right now in that garden. She doesn't need to keep checking and coming in and going, are you sure you're okay if it's this one and not that one? Are you sure it shouldn't be that color and not this color? Because I'm okay with that. If it's going to directly affect me in a way that would be potentially harmful, then you would need my consent. At the same time, though, it's acknowledging that maybe some people can't have can't give consent. You know, there might be people in a coma. There might be people who don't have the capacity to understand their own well-being in some way, sort of a paternalistic argument. But I would still argue, even there, you shouldn't be making any decision for those people, say a newborn baby, that is not based on what is best for them. You still, whoever's making decisions for them, the thinking must still be what is best for you, not what is best for me or what is best for the powers that be or what is best for someone. So I'm only saying that there are some people who physically or mentally may not be able to, you know, access their freedom at certain points or in some times. And then there are other situations where it just doesn't bother me what is done with certain things, and I don't need, and it's almost my autonomous decision to not want to be bothered with the decision about it, if I don't want to be. So I can sort of, you know, just happily defer to your choices on whatever you're going to do in that thing, because it's up to you and I don't care.
But I mean, to sort of expand on that, and we'll get onto your sort of codification of what means better. But when it comes to sort of exclusion, you know, you work at a school, you're a teacher. Sometimes students just need to be told, okay, shut up. You don't know the right answer to this because you're not in the position of power. And I know you've sort of you sort of said that that's a wary sort of justification of authority. But at some points, you do need to sort of say, like, we can't include everybody in this decision.
So in terms of authority, so anarchism can still have authority, but it's a temporary and purposeful sort of flexible, mutually shared thing. So you're right. If we were building a bridge in our community, you don't want my opinions on the bridge because I don't know engineering. I don't know the maths behind it. I don't know the structure and I don't know the materials that should be used. I would definitely say, don't talk to me. You don't need my opinion. Talk to the engineers. And if I was giving my opinion at a meeting about the bridge and it was totally irrelevant, you know, the engineers who actually know about the stuff were saying all the things, and I would say, well, I think it should be made of paper. Paper bridges are always my favorite bridge when I was a child. You are quite right to be able to explain to me. Again, it's not about authority. It's not about saying shut up. It's about saying, look, we're here to try and move forward with this bridge. We can demonstrably show that a paper bridge doesn't work. We don't think your contributions are helpful. You can still make them. You know, I don't think you've got the right to shut me up, but hopefully enough people at the meeting recognizing that what I'm saying is not really of value in that meeting will make me realize that maybe I am not the right person to be speaking here. The problem with school, to go to the school example that you gave, is schools are a very problematic institution. You know, schools are this weird thing of like, you do need to tell people to be quiet because we're there to learn and you're forced to be there. School is not a choice. You know, you will find certainly, for example, it's very rare a university lecturer will tell someone to shut up because the people there have all chosen to pay and be there. And even at the lecture, you may not have to be, you know, you could stay in bed that day. No one's going to really care if you didn't go to the lecture. So they might ask you to leave, but they're not going to tell you to be quiet, in the same way that in school, the law has forced you into that classroom. And the school curriculum, in many cases, certainly in the lower school before you get to A level, will have forced you to study the subjects, whether you care about them or not. And so you're in this weird position as a teacher where for 50 minutes, 2 hours, whatever your long length your lesson is, you have people in a room who maybe don't want to be there, who it's not that they need to listen and learn the subject that you're talking, but if they are disrupting it, the people who do want to don't get the right to learn the thing that they want to learn. And then on top of that, you've got the fact that a lot of the content that you're teaching is not even something you as a teacher think is worth teaching. It's something from an exam spec or a curriculum devised by a head of department or a school program that they've got, something that they've decided is important. So you're kind of teaching arbitrary information to people who don't want to hear it. And so that creates a tension that leads to very odd states of discipline and punishment and authority that really have no business being in a civil society, but our schools at the moment are in an uncivil society.
So again, the sort of wider argument that you're essentially making is, I'm giving you these examples, these sort of rebuttals, but your whole main point is that, hey, listen, if you want to achieve something, you have to be able to provide a justified explanation for it. And if you want authority, you're going to have to provide a justified explanation for why that authority is legitimate, why that authority should be followed, why we should defer to your opinion in the situation. As you say, in the university room, the reason why people shut up or just don't speak and take notes is because they've made that consenting sort of decision to say, hey, this person knows more about this subject than us, because the institutions, and I mean, like, not to get too deep into it, have said, yeah, this person's a professor, you can learn from him, we decide which professors we sort of want to learn from, what universities want to go to. And that sort of format of making decisions and having authority is totally justified. But when it becomes unjustified is the sort of view that certain people do need to shut up without an explanation, because in fact it's only that explanation that makes it a legitimate form of authority.
Yeah, and in fact that I would say that the problem with the classroom is that we cannot justify our authority as teachers, because a lot of the time there is no justification for what we're doing in that classroom. We are teaching people how to jump through hoops for exam boards for exams that aren't even relevant or important. So because of that, we are forced to say, well, I'll give you detention if you continue to disrupt, because I can't even send you out of the classroom because you're legally required to be there.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a messed up situation. An interesting thing about schools as well is we are told by our government in the country right now to promote democracy as a form. You know, within the classroom, we are supposed to show you that democracy is important. And yet, you know, sometimes I ask students, how democratic is your school? So you're a student at school. How many times have you personally been talked to by the teacher about the curriculum and been involved in a decision of how to plan the curriculum? I can tell you at our school, we've planned curriculums for our students because we've been, you know, told to by senior leaders that we have to think about our lesson planning. Never once in those conversations did it say, and as part of the procedure, talk to your classes, you know, see what they want to know, be democratic about it, let some of them teach the lessons. How democratic is your school? If you've been to school and you've never had a say in who your teachers are, in what content's being taught to you, in how the school day runs, you don't go to a you don't live in a democracy in that school. And the idea that schools are supposed to talk about democracy is laughable.
There's a hypocrisy there, and sort of. And what some people may be thinking is that why I'm asking these questions is because when you were speaking earlier about there's no sort of larger political teleology or ethical teleology that we can sort of, or as you said, rules in the sky. The sort of moral relativism, essentially, which is what I wanted to stray away from, because I think that's an unfair criticism, because you actually do talk about working from sort of what you call species facts to species interests, essentially deriving a common humanity that can be generally applied to judge a system against, or at least be aims that our artificially constructed systems should look for, writing down 8 facts that you believe are sort of universally true for human beings, and then 8 interests that sort of come from them. So an example of some of these are: human beings are finite biological and we're fragile creatures with a capacity to feel pain. Therefore, it's in our interest to avoid unnecessary death and preventable suffering. Things like human beings hold a desire to continue living for as long as possible, if all things are being equal. And therefore, we should have an interest in being able to hold and fulfill one species' interest and informing and holding other interests, both as an individual and in conjunction with others, and having the reasonable capacity to carry them out. So you do sort of still, even in the, again, moving from the sort of if or nonsense that sort of we were talking about earlier, there is sort of some codification and universality that we can sort of draw off of and pick towards it when we're making such decisions.
Yes, but just to caveat it again, that's why politics is necessarily ethical, and there is a political teleology that I'm not necessarily saying these are objectively true morality that we should base an ethical system off. It's a possible candidate for one. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm not having people having to commit to the idea of there being these are the ethical rules of the world. But what I am saying is, in a political thinking where you are asking the question, who are the people and what is better for them, to say that this is going to make life better for people, once you've made the decision, well, people must be all people, because there is no really good grounds to exclude anyone from that definition, you're left with going, okay, if I need to say what is better for someone, so this is back to, if I've got the facts of the ears, I can get to the ought, to say what is better for people, if people are all people, it has to be, what are the things we can say are commonly true of all of humanity? And so what I've offered is like, well, these are some things that I think we can agree on are universally true of all people. You don't have to be a member of a particular, you know, ideological or faith position or a certain gender or race or sexuality. These are, as a human, you have these. And they're not human rights. They're not things that are, you know, rights are a construct many people have problems with. They're not saying that God said it. They're just saying, like, looking at humans as a thing, what is true about humans? Because we have said humans are the thing that we are making politics for life to be better for those humans. So we need to know what they are. And then, like I say, from that, we can say, okay, if it is true that humans are A, B, and C, it entails that it is in their interest to do X, Y, and Z.
So essentially, there's a sort of, if we want to do this and we recognize human beings are the sort of people we want to benefit, we have to understand what human beings are like and what actually benefits them, so that we can legitimize our sort of political decisions or our political structures. In basically layman terms, that's what you're arguing here.
Yeah, as a basic level of what it would mean to make life better for people, if people are everyone, when you look at everyone as humans, qua humans, and go, what is a fact about humans and what would that mean would make life better for them? I'm saying at the bare minimum, it's these things. And it is a real minimal list. And the point,
And it's very general as well.
Yeah. It's intentionally general, intentionally minimal, to say this is the basic standard of what a legitimate society should be protecting and enabling. If it does that, that's great. And if it does that, you know, my argument in the book is that the best system to doing that would be a form of authentic democracy, which would be anarchism. But it's also a critical tool you can use to look at your own society and go, well, if that is the bare minimum of what would make life better for people, you know, does our society in its current form do that?
I mean, that's a great link into the next part when you talk about anarchism as the response to sort of all of these current problems you brought up. But if we sort of start, you rightly state that anarchism is potentially the most misunderstood political doctrine in the history of political thought. And you say that it's largely because it's counterintuitive to most accepted theories of politics and government, which generally assume the unquestionable necessity of an external state and that should be above society to carry out the goals of legitimate politics. And we've sort of spoken about that, about the sort of state realism that people like who have a Hobbesian view, or even Rousseau and Locke sort of bring out, or even someone like Nozick with his sort of invisible state of invisible hand of the state argument that he sort of brings up. But you also state that anarchism has a problem in terms of a specific and identifiable political doctrine, that anarchism is necessarily somewhat lacking. So what makes anarchism misunderstood in this sense? Do anarchists and political theory make it easier or harder to access such modes of political thought?
Well, yeah, it's not that anarchism is misunderstood, I think, in such as if you understand it, it's not necessarily universally clear that everyone agrees on what exactly it is. So when you understand a free system involves freedom, then you have different interpretations which are equally valid. So, for example, sorry, I just had to take a drink. There are anarchists who I'm sure would read my book and say, that's not my anarchism. And there are anarchists who I've read who I go, yeah, that's not the sort of anarchism I would agree with. And what I think both of us would agree as anarchists is that our versions of anarchism have a right to breathe within an anarchy. So it's that idea of experimentation and capacity for experimenting with different ways of living, different ideas and different thoughts, that sort of lead to what seems like a bit of a mess as a theory. To, you know, normally a theory has like, if it's A, B, and C, it is that thing. And anarchism might not. Now, there are attempts to conceptualize anarchism so it does. And there's things like, you know, commitment to anti-hierarchy, and sort of focus on things like prefiguration. So trying, you know, we recognize you can't have anarchism today because of the problem that we're talking about. People think there should be a government. But what you can do is try and live as if there isn't a government where you can, and show people with what you're doing how the world could be. So you see this with like mutual aid during coronavirus, where you didn't need a government organization. You might just have neighborhoods coming together and going, who needed food? We've got food. You can't go out, you're shielding. Let's bring you some food and things like that. So no one organizes that. That is anarchism. And whether it's done intentionally by anarchists trying to sort of make a point about anarchy, or just by communities who don't realize what they're doing is anarchy, you see in that moment, these ideas of how a better world could be. So different anarchists do different things, and there are attempts to try and sort of string it all together, these kind of commitments to different power structures and lack of hierarchical authority structures. But because it's necessarily a system where people have different views, you will end up with more of a smorgasbord of anarchisms than one particular this is anarchy. At the same time, the misunderstanding comes because people are raised in a society where, you know, you have parents who are authoritarian, you go to school with authoritarian teachers in a country that usually has a government of some level of authoritarianism. You've always been told you need leaders. You've always been told you need someone to tell you whether it's correct and permissible to do what you want to do. Yeah. So when someone comes along and says, we don't need that, it seems self-evidently wrong. And it also seems scary because you think immediately, well, if we took all of that away here now, what would happen? And for many people, what would happen would we'd all kill each other, because it turns out apparently, even though if you talk to most people, they've never wanted to murder anyone in their life, they believe everyone else does. And if you took the law away, everyone would kill each other. But I am more sympathetic to the fact that most people I've talked to don't want to kill people. You know, if you took the law away today, I have no inclination to go out and murder a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And importantly, from my point of view, you'll notice that murder is still a thing. So we've always had laws against murder, and the people who want to go out and kill people are still doing it, yeah. Right? It hasn't actually stopped that. So my feeling is, and there's a philosopher called, you know, Malatesta, he's an Italian philosopher, I think, is Italian. And he basically talks about, kind of like Plato's prisoners in a cave, he talks about being born with leg braces on and being taught to walk. And he says, that's kind of what the state is. You think you can walk, and you think you rely on the leg braces to be able to walk. But if someone took away the leg braces, you realize you could actually run. But we don't think we can walk without them, so we keep them on.
Yeah, you wrote about that in a recent Philosophy Unleashed blog, I read that, yeah.
I did, yes. Yeah. So that sort of a metaphor really sticks with me.
Interesting point as well, because it really made me think about sort of my personally, as someone you've taught me, as someone who naturally sort of takes lead in these sort of positions, and sort of why I had that intuitive sort of not alienation, sort of hesitancy towards anarchism. Because I had always, in my experience, been like, well, I don't believe that sort of anyone could just sort of make these decisions. We can't have leaders. Because whenever I'm in the classroom, for example, I mean, you've seen this, I'm the only one who puts my hand up. I'm the only person who goes forward and says anything. And whenever you organize group situations, whenever it's my group, you sort of expect, oh yeah, Hassan's done everything. Hassan's written the whole PowerPoint. But then I also realized that that was actually, like, sort of when I began to unpack it, that that came out of years of conditioning of my parents telling me, Mohammed, you have to go take a lead. Mohammed, you have to go and be the person who organizes everything. And I come from a family where we sort of brought up to sort of do that. And then school, the school system, sort of facilitates that as well, because those students who go and take lead out of themselves are rewarded and pushed further, instead of students who are maybe more hesitant being taught to also involve themselves. And you sort of get that natural separation. I mean, you see it in, as a teacher in multiple classrooms, where there's almost a facilitation of the apathy from certain students, and a sort of and that's why you sort of get those systems of power occurring. So they're not even really natural in that sense that some people think they are.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what I was saying in the blog, is we are trained into sort of infantilism or learned helplessness of, if you're told you need a leader to tell you what to do, you wait for a leader. And if there's no leader, you don't do it. And it's being brave enough to be the leader that gets things done. But what anarchism says is we should all be that brave, and we should all work together and realize you don't need a leader. You just need everyone to be doing their bit. And so part of being a leader, and I would say I've seen this with some students. You might recognize yourself in this, you might not, but the people who are able to sort of stand up and take lead, that's great. But what they're not necessarily able to do, which again, we would need to do in anarchism, and anarchism sort of teaches about, is also step back when other people want to take over some of that leadership too.
Totally,
and yeah. So I come from an improv background as well as political philosophy, where, you know, the whole thing with improv is you're making stuff up. I love improv as a sort of example of anarchism. You don't have a script, you don't have rules about what you're going to do. There are some basic principles you follow, but even they can be broken at the appropriate time. But the big thing in improv is, you know, if we're not working to a script, if we're developing a scene that's just based on what we're saying in the moment, do I come into that scene and take over the scene? Or do I come into the scene and take over when I need to take over, let other people take over when they need to take over, work mutually together for a lot of it at the same level? And those are the scenes that work more effectively, when you actually realize it's give and take. And often, you know, I've done whole improv shows where I really don't do a lot in the show, but what I do is I stand back and listen and go where help is needed. And I'm just a very small part to help something go along. Other shows, I'll go and I'll sort of dominate every scene. And then the better shows, there's a nice balance of all of that. And I think it's all about recognizing that, you know, authority is not a thing that should be deferred to. It's something that is a flexible thing that's given for good reasons, taken away for good reasons, shared between groups of people. I think in our current society, we're not told that. So, you know, if you have a problem, this links to protesting. If you have a problem, go to the right person, you know, follow the right line of procedure, go to the right authority rather than lead on it yourself. Imagine in a school situation, let's say the teachers have a problem with the latest government thing, the curriculum, a behavior policy, whatever it is. Well, we could wait for the government to change their mind. We could do a big long fight to try and change our particular school's policy. Or we can all just agree as teachers, go, well, in our school, we're not going to do that. Let's just do it this way, and just do it. Mm-hmm. And very rarely do people do that third option, because that would require all of us taking responsibility. And that's just in my profession. You know, that could be anywhere. People don't always realize they have the ability to sort of just do it, just take
it's
over.
It's important to stress.
Together.
It's important to stress that apathy that you talk about is not a natural inclination. People aren't just naturally apathetic to causes they care about, but it's almost part of our sort of ideological structures. I mean, when you look at the sort of the movies that we watch, and I think Slavoj Žižek is sort of touted as being this sort of fanciful philosopher who, you know, he talks a lot of nonsense. But I think it's sort of relevant in sort of our conversation right here. When you look at movies, the person who sort of touted as the hero, the savior, is this individual who sort of breaks free, and sort of even when they're not working sort of mutual, not working within the lines, and sort of do what you say is go against it, there's sort of still this individually leader-led sort of situation where we're told that we need this one individual to sort of stand up and take a grasp and make sort of be the great man sort of scenario that we sort of get. And it's interesting that you talk about in your book about capitalism and ideology, and how it's not in just our sort of leisure time, it's not in just sort of when we're at work, but it's a much wider corporate enterprise that fuels these sort of modes of thinking, that fuels these sort of views and perspectives on the world, that if we were really given autonomous choices, we would naturally disagree with them a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, we are constantly told it's the world is about individuals, and you said the great man, and you know, as again, feminism would tell you, it is often depicted as the great man, until recently. And I think that there is a big, you know, in all kinds of walks of life, we are told that it's all about the individual, and collective power is so important. I mean, what I was just talking about with teachers standing up is interesting, because it just made me think of the, there's been a movement since the Black Lives Matter thing last year to try and decolonize curriculums and things like that, and change and diversify things. But there was already, you know, this problem has been well known as being part of certainly British education, not teaching about colonialism and things like that. And there was a whole range of Black-led schools, supplementary schools, in Birmingham, where we live, that, you know, and around the country, there was exactly what I said. Instead of waiting for someone to do it, the Black communities in the area just were like, well, we will educate the children on the stuff that they're not learning at school, or where schools were being racist and not teaching students basic stuff because they said, oh, they couldn't do it. Rather than waiting for the schools to improve, they said, well, we'll teach them on a Saturday. So again, back to that thing of classroom authority, on a Saturday, people were choosing to go to school that they didn't have to go to, were running schools for no pay that they didn't have to run, but everyone, it was a collective project. Not only did they show they had the power to sort of take things in their own hands, share the power between people, you know, in the community. Can you teach a class? Yeah, sure. Can you teach a class? Sure. Can you make some food? Whatever. And sharing all those responsibilities out, but also solving a problem that if you just sat around waiting, we would still be waiting for today, because as we can see from the protests, it still hasn't been solved. I was just gonna say, linking to the movie thing, this idea that we need to step up and do stuff. If you did that as an individual, those schools would not have worked. If one person said, well, I'm gonna just open my house on a Saturday and kids can come here and learn stuff, that's not the same thing as a community working together. And it was only because of multiple people working together and sharing it that it became something that people invested in, rather than one person's, you know, one person project. So I think we are often told it's about those great individuals, and that is specifically to silence us from thinking of sharing our ideas with others. We also have intellectual property. So if I have a really good idea, do I want to share it with other people, or do I want to try and monetize it myself and make it my own? And, you know, because if I don't, someone else will, and then I'm at the bottom of the pile in our dog-eat-dog society. So we're often taught to kind of stay separated. It's divide and rule.
I think that perfectly links to a listener question, because I put out on my Instagram story, I'm going to be doing this interview. Do you have any sort of questions you'd like to ask? And someone asked, in an anarchist society, they asked, would punishment not exist? And how do you solve the problems caused by that? And they say, if there are no laws about things like intellectual property, which you bring up, what protection do creatives have? But I think the point that you're making here is that we're taking problems that exist in the current system, in the current dog-eat-dog world we have, and sort of translating them onto a system that is radically different, I wouldn't create the same sort of cultures and systems that we currently have. If we were to take ourselves away from this dog-eat-dog capitalist society and had a mutual aid project, we wouldn't need to worry so much about people stealing our ideas and making a bunch of money off of them, because the same structures just would not exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, there will be no crime in anarchy and everything would be perfect, because we will make mistakes. People do things and people make, you know, decisions that are bad. But a lot of the motivating forces that currently cause most of our crimes are related to the economic system that's deeply unequal and individualistic. Essentially, in our current world, no one cares if you live or die. We might pretend we do and implement welfare systems, but even there, we sort of make you feel bad that you're depending on it. We want to get you off it as soon as possible. And you're kind of told you failed a bit and you should have figured out a way of earning a living for yourself. So you're kind of on your own. And that leads you to steal. That leads you to want the best ideas that you can monetize versus other people. That leads you to feel that everyone else is a competitor to you. You know, as I've said before in the classroom, you in a class of people in a school should be thinking, well, we're all the kids in this society, you know, at the same age working together. That's kind of interesting. But we make you competitors. There's only a finite number of, you know, grade nines, A star grades. There's only a finite number of university places. There's only a finite number of good jobs. And we are, our job is to turn you against each other to compete for those positions. So rather than you guys all working together to make sure you all leave the class at the end of your school time, do we all know the same stuff? Did we learn the things we wanted to learn? Yeah. You are told to fight against each other in silent exams and see who's the best.
And we're punished if we work against that. I mean, like, our class was notoriously punished for, I'm not sure if you heard about this, what we would do is, again, so this natural anarchist inclination that we have is, if we found out that there was an exam coming up, we would say, okay, which class is going first? Let's organize some sort of rota. What's the mark scheme and what's all of this? Now, of course, there's sort of ethical sort of grudge, oh, why are you cheating and stuff? But at the end of the day, we were all working together so that we could get the good grade so that we could all succeed. But sort of the school not only doesn't want that happening, the education system doesn't want that happening, but actively punishes you when you try and make it so that everybody succeeds.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the examination system is a catastrophe because it is not about actual learning. So the reason that the school would frown upon that, or any school would frown upon that, is because exams are about what can you remember in a timed condition by yourself. And if you know the questions in advance, it's unrealistic. So schools can make lots of very righteous arguments about, well, that's not helpful to you, because if you got the answers in advance, then you're not going to have that in the exam. And therefore, this test won't give you the, you know, the real life experience of preparing you for a proper exam and all of that garbage. But the reason it's garbage is because that is true. But what is it testing other than memory? Nothing. Whereas if the intention of the exam is that we learn the material, if we all have the questions and we all work hard to understand that we can answer the questions, then when I give you the correct answer, does that show that I've learned the material? Does that show that I understand it? Maybe it does. Often it doesn't. It just shows you've just regurgitated some stuff. But that's because the system that we have is one that is encouraging regurgitation of stuff rather than proper understanding. So I agree. I think, you know, it's a mutual collective aid to go like, well, how do we all learn? And if you guys had a study group where you didn't share the questions and you all just talked about the material and tried to learn it together, we would be absolutely fine with that. What we didn't like as a school, clearly, is an attempt to undermine and subvert this unjustifiable system of examination, because that makes us ask questions about it, which we can't answer back to the authority thing. So the instinct is to tell you off.
Yeah.
That is basically, you know, there's going to be punishment of some sort, but punishment's an interesting question, or an interesting word. You know, the idea that wrongdoing requires a response may be true. The idea that response needs to be punishment is deeply questionable and based on all kinds of retributive, you know, inclinations that have again been propagated into us from generations of people who have those inclinations, you know, from religious upbringing, from parental upbringing, from school discipline. There's all kinds of reasons that you could argue that when someone does something wrong, yes, maybe something needs to be done to protect people, to stop that from happening. But is the something that needs to be done punishment, or is it stop that from happening again, address the issue that caused it? So back to the original point, you know, capitalism causes all those crimes that are about me, me, me. But even things like mental health things, objectification, things like murder, rape, stuff like that, there are connections to that and the lifestyle of capitalism, the way we are taught to think, the way we're taught to repress our mental health problems, the way we're taught to see people as commodities, you know, to be exploited. The murderer, the rapist, they are using people, you know, for their own ends. That's what every boss does. That's what every person is grown up to be told. That is how someone will treat you. So that's clearly wrong. That message of how to treat people is what your school system, for example, has drilled into you, said, we will tell you what to do, where to go. If we want to have you in detention, take away your free time, we'll tell you to sit in that room. If we tell you to be quiet, you'll be quiet. And we're doing this so that you can one day sell yourself to a boss who will do the same and tell you, spend your weekend doing that, take away your holiday, don't feed your family, all of that stuff. So I think if you took away those structures, a lot of the inclinations to a lot of the crimes would go. You may still have people doing these crimes, but then the question is the response, does it need to be punishment?
Mm. And you bring up again capitalism and democracy, and you're fundamentally opposed that such capitalist systems can maintain a real democracy or a justified democracy, because the argument or the sort of narrative that has been recently is ever since the fall of the USSR and the ending of this sort of, the end of the First World War, this sort of Fukuyamist idea of sort of the end of history, is that capitalism, particularly in the West, Western capitalism, in contrast to the authoritarianism of the USSR or China or whatever, and other states that sprang up in the 20th century from fascism, communism and whatnot, that it was only the sort of market mechanism that could give us such a free society. It's only the market enterprise, which people like Robert Nozick touted such a system of free market enterprise as the ultimate way for democracy to function. Why do you disagree with this? And why would somebody who's an anarcho-capitalist, like there are, essentially be toting an oxymoron?
Well, yeah, I mean, I in the book, I don't say that capitalism is incoherent with authentic democracy. I just say that if you look at the examples of capitalist societies, they don't seem to meet the criteria of being an authentic democracy. It's, of course, possible that that there might be one as the anarcho-capitalist thing. I disagree with that. I also disagree that we have a free society. And I think that's one of the big problems. We don't have a free society. We have a society where we have to sell the majority of our lives to jobs to make money for someone else and to pay for a living which should be ours just by virtue of being alive. We are forced to sacrifice important things like friends, family, our well-being, mentally, our just, you know, leisure time, free time, for all kinds of stupid external reasons that are created by this system. And the only thing free is markets. And these markets don't bring freedom to everyone. They bring great poverty and inequality, material inequalities as well. There are people in some countries who, you know, their version of what quality of life is radically different from people in other countries. So the idea that you could look at the world and go, oh, this is brilliant, this is perfect, this is free, is, I would say, demonstrably not true. I'd also say that they emphasize freedom too much. It's not about just being free. It's about having all those species' interests fulfilled. And freedom is just one of them. We need to be as free as possible, but I don't believe that we should be so free that if I want to kill you, I can kill you. We should be so free that if I want to sabotage all of your most beloved things, I should be able to do that. We should be free in a way that we can all be free. And we can't be free if we don't know where our next meal is coming from and if we don't have a roof over our heads. So there are other things that we need to take consideration of that the capitalist system doesn't. And again, I'm not saying that alternative systems, that, you know, USSR is a better system. There are certainly huge, horrific human rights abuses and terrible atrocities that happened there. I would argue it was never really communism. And I would argue that communism is not really meant to be the case either. Even Marx, ultimately, when you boil it down, ends up advocating anarchism. And I disagree with any of these kind of violent approaches, revolutionarily violent approaches to try and change society. And I think as an anarchist, I'm kind of committed to, it has to be a free decision for us to do it. We can't just force you by the barrel of a gun to become an anarchist, or else you're not really doing anarchy. So it's a long process, and it probably won't happen in my lifetime or several generations of lifetimes. But I just think the idea that this of what we've got is the pinnacle of civilization is absolute bullshit.
So, I mean, that brings us on to the sort of some final few points I want to make, is that your only concession about anarchism that you bring up is exactly what you sort of said. It's going to be a difficult, it's going to be a long process, because for it to be legitimate, for us to sort of stay, not ideologically pure, because I think that's quite loaded, but to stay like authentic is a better word, to our sort of goals. Coherent. And coherent, yes, is a good word. It has to be this legitimate, consentful process. So one of the questions that one of the listeners said is that, what are the processes we can do now to lead us towards that anarchistic society? Because I, of course, at the end of a lot of my podcasts, speak about sort of organization, getting involved outside of Twitter, because if you get involved in that hellscape, you just get lost forever. How can we, in the real world, bring about as closer to an anarchist society as possible?
Well, like the great revolutionary anarchist company Nike say, just do it. Basically, you just do it. This idea of prefiguration that I mentioned earlier, of creating the society you want to see in the cracks of the current society so that it kind of blossoms in the ashes of the old world, is really, I think, the most inspiring thing about anarchism. You don't need to wait for permission to be an anarchist. You can choose to ignore authority structures. You can choose to find spaces where you can do your own thing. You know, you can make decisions. So like you say, your class saying, well, let's share the answers anyway. We'll get told off, but let's do it. You know, you can go to university and learn some stuff and do a podcast and share it with people for free and show that you don't need to become a capitalist about it. You know, you could offer your services in your local community. You could create spaces where people can create stuff for a better future today. So one of the great things, you don't have to worry about it in terms of, yeah, I'm not going to live in an anarchist society. That's a long way off. But what can I do today? You know, is it next time there's a pandemic, make sure that my neighbors have got food, make sure people beyond my neighbors have got food, you know, share stuff more. Whatever it is, being an anarchist means recognizing that just because there are certain rules in place now doesn't mean they have to be followed. And by what there's a philosopher called James C. Scott. He's actually, I think he's a sociologist or anthropologist. But he's got this idea of like anarchist calisthenics, where you sort of train yourself to do a bit of anarchy every day. So he says, like, you know, crossing the light, crossing the road against the light is a bit of anarchist calisthenics. You realize I actually can just use my own reason and figure out it's safe to cross the road. I don't need to wait for it to go green. But that's true in all kinds of ways. I can do a bit of anarchist calisthenics when I disrupt a system, when I provide an alternative for something just today. You know, I don't need to wait till tomorrow.
Yeah. But do we, just on that point, do we not also need to engage in the electoral sort of politics and systems? I know that we had a disagreement earlier this year, actually last year in 2020, over the Joe Biden election, where you sort of said that even at some point, you sort of, and Noam Chomsky also articulates this point, that at some point you do have to go with the lesser of two evils. That even though Joe Biden is still a war criminal and imperialist, that he fundamentally is objectively different to Trump, and we sometimes have to bite the nail.
I definitely don't think doing what I just said means taking yourself out of society entirely. You are still part of this society. You're still connected. So back to that connection, plurality, and finitude of Honora O'Neill. I am an American citizen. I did vote in that election. If I did not vote for Joe Biden, that is me saying I want Donald Trump to win. And I can pretend it doesn't matter because, like, fuck the system, it's not really anything. But that is a kind of naive view of the world that we currently live in. And that is condemning the people of America to have four more years under Trump. Now, Biden is terrible. Yes, they're all terrible. And that's fine. But the narrative of a Biden presidency ideologically is different than the narrative of a Trump presidency, because Biden has a narrative that says, I am here to care about people in a way that that Trump guy didn't. And so all of that sort of information becomes a reality of sorts. Biden is not perfect. Biden is bad in loads of ways, but Biden is, by some standards, making life better for people than life under Trump would be. So ultimately, none of them are great. We want authentic democracy, but we don't have that now. And to say, because we don't have that, I'm gonna, you know, throw my toys out the pram and just condemn people to living in a worse state of affairs than we can, is, I think, not ethical. You know, any ethical situation, it's like, do I make the right choice, the better choice, or do I make things worse? I think you should make things better. Now, that might be proven wrong. We don't know, because we can't do counterfactuals of what the world might be and what it isn't and stuff like that. Could be Biden starts some terrible war and lots of people die and Trump wouldn't have done that. But based on what we knew at the time, it seems like if you had a choice, pick him over the other. But that's not to say either are great. Although I think, you know, I won the lottery the day Joe Biden won the presidency. It wasn't the best thing in the world, but it was good that Trump didn't win that presidency.
Yeah. Again, fundamentally, we're working off of that axiom of making the world better for as many people or all people as you possibly can, because that is the legitimate way to make politics, to do politics and ethical business. So thank you for this interview. It's been really enjoyable. I hope everybody who listened learned some stuff about anarchism, learned about how they don't need permission to get changes made and don't need to wait for electoral systems or other people to tell them what to do, what they can or cannot do. Again, thank you, Dan McKee, for coming on. Is there any last words you'd want to say?
No, just thank you. It's been really nice chatting about it, and I hope people enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you have a great day. And that was The Propaganda Machine.